So, welcome everybody, it's nice to be back here again. You all know that I'm a Londoner. It's always great to be back in the town of my birth with so many memories. All happy ones being here. Because London, a very huge multicultural city, and building friendship with one another and a sense of community is so important. Sometimes when I was here as a Buddhist, I would go to some of these temples and Buddhist societies. I would go and listen to the talk, do some meditation, and quickly rush out to go back home. You've all been working today, and I'm not sure if you had any dinner this evening, but don't worry, you can eat the Dhamma. It is more delicious. But you may not have had much time today. And for me in those days, I'd rush back home. And I would listen to teachings. And I would meditate. But I would not be making any friends who are similar to me. Now this was in the 60s, when I didn't know where I could find other Buddhists who were like me, who could share the same philosophy, share the same kindness, share the same wisdom. And that made me feel actually quite isolated and lonely. And so when I managed to start forming my own Buddhist societies over in Australia and in other places as well, I knew how important it was to have a cup of tea afterwards. To be able to speak to one another and find this beautiful family, the community, which like-minded people who could look after one another, care for one another, inspire one another, help one another. And that spiritual community became an important part of the success of my organization in Australia. Not just the teachings, not just the wisdom, not just the meditation, but giving the opportunity for people to come together. And we all know, as a single person, we can only do so much. But as a community, we can do so much more. So much to inspire, lead, and make London a better place because of our sense of community. So what that really means is that little acts of kindness, little acts of friendship will never ever get forgotten. Recently, when I was in San Francisco, someone told me the story of a man who was driving in Northern California and his car broke down. And he wasn't actually an IT, he was in IT, but he was hopeless fixing cars. So he tried his iPhone, no signal, it was too remote. So he was stuck there for an hour or two until a farmer drove by in his truck, in his lorry. And the farmers always help one another. So this farmer stopped to help this man who had broken down in the middle of nowhere. And the farmer was able to fix the problem so the gentleman could drive off, shook hands, said thank you, and they parted. 3 or 4 days later, that farmer got a letter from his bank. All his debts had been paid off, and a large sum of money was deposited in his credit account, because that man was none other than Bill Gates. Bill Gates had broken down, and he knows nothing about fixing cars, and his iPhone would not reach any tower to get a signal, and not even he could make it work. And so he was so lucky when he saw this farmer to get him out of a problem. Bill Gates took down the number plate of the truck, and of course he used his connections, which are extensive, to find out the owner of the truck, to find out his bank account, and to find out this man, like many farmers, was in a lot of debt. Paid it all off, and a little bit extra, you know, to celebrate. And that was the kindness which a Bill Gates can do when someone else shows kindness to him. That apparently is a true story, which I heard in San Francisco 1 year ago. Moral of that story is, if you go home tonight and see someone broken down by the side of the road, it will be... Who knows who it could be? Who's the younger of 30 now? That's Branson. Perhaps it could be Branson. It could be all sorts of millionaires in this town. Forget that. It could be Queen Elizabeth. Unlikely, but who knows? But that's just an act of kindness. Creates this wonderful sense of community and friendship. And of course, I cannot give you any money. I don't have that. But I've given people kindness all over the world. And it makes this incredible sense of community which I belong to. And sometimes people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, what country, what nationality are you? And that, in this my time of life, is such a difficult question to answer. And I say this because I go to so many other countries and I serve. I do go to Sri Lanka. I'd love to go there more often, but I often say Sri Lanka has got so many monks, I don't know why they have to import one from Australia. But I go there anyway. And when I go to Sri Lanka, I see so many of my friends there, so many of the places I remember, so many of the smells. That's like a home to me. And then I leave Sri Lanka and I go to Malaysia. I've got so many friends there, just even on the bus. Coming here from East Croydon Station, I've got myself an Oyster card now. A lady said, "Oh, good afternoon, Ajahn Brahm." She was from Penang. And she goes to my talks whenever she's in Penang, Malaysia, and also listens to me on YouTube. So I go to Penang a lot and have a community and friends there as well. And in fact, I was at a conference. I think it was in Vietnam. And the Malaysian delegation, the official Malaysian delegation, were meeting in front of the conference venue for the official photograph. And they unfurled the Malaysian flag. Now, Malaysia has got many Muslims, but also a high number of Buddhists who I go and help out. And so they unfurled the Malaysian flag for the official photograph of the Malaysian delegation. And I was walking past at the time, and they shouted, "Ajahn Brahm, come over here." I said, "But I am not Malaysian." "Yes, you are. Come in." And so I got in the official photograph for the Malaysian delegation. And you may think I was representing Australia, but actually I was representing Singapore at that conference, because that is also a second home for me. So I've got so many people in Singapore. And I've got so many friends, even now in Korea as well. Last February, I was invited to Korea for a special event. What had happened was the Pope had gone to Korea. And the Buddhists were really upset. And they went, "How can we do something to keep up with the Christians? By keeping up with the Joneses?" So they decided to have another event to match that. Seven great meditation masters, and they invited me as one of those. And they had the event in a convention center up in the mountains. Actually, the site of the next Winter Olympics. And it was minus 15 degrees centigrade outside. And they wanted us all to go on what they called the Saints Walk on top of the mountains. It was covered with snow. It was minus 15 degrees. And I didn't have any socks. No hats. I wore the same shoes as I wore here today. And so what did I do? I just walked. Walked without any socks, barefoot, in the snow, minus 15 degrees. And people say, "Did you feel cold?" The answer is no. After a few minutes, you don't feel anything. No, that's not true. That's only a joke. No, it's fine. Because I have the method, which I call Buddhist climate control. because I know you thought it was getting a bit hot in here.
And especially leaning against the radiator. It's going to be hot. You're blinding yourself.
So anyway, Buddhist climate control. If it's hot, you keep a cool head. Don't worry about it. Don't think about it. When it's hot, keep a cool head. When it's cold, keep a warm heart. And that means it's Buddhist climate control. It's balance. So please remember, when it's hot, keep a cool head. Don't think about it. And when it's cold, keep a warm heart. And that way, you're able to be able to live in the world without any need for aircon or heating. And save a lot of money and also do something like I did, be able to walk in 1 to 15 degrees centigrade with no problem whatsoever. But I mention that because I have now got the most famous feet in South Korea. The reason was because this was televised, a couple of national TV channels, and after a while they weren't photographing the monk, they were looking at my feet. These cameras were pointing at my feet. My feet were broadcast live to every town and city in South Korea. The most famous feet of this stupid Australian monk, was Australian, Sri Lankan, I don't know what nationality I am, who could actually walk in the snow without any problem whatsoever. The power of Buddhist climate control. But anyhow, so I go to Korea as well. Many friends there, so I'm half Korean. And then I go to Australia as well. I actually live there. So sometimes people say, are you really Australian? You're always going away. So they complain I spend too much time in places like London and Malaysia. So anyway, where do you actually belong? This whole world is my community. And even the Muslim world as well. I go to Indonesia a lot. My books are very famous there. And I built a huge community in Australia, in Indonesia. So much so that I was travelling from Perth to Bali, not to go surfing, not to go to a resort, but actually to go to give some talks and teach a retreat. And on Garuda Airlines, as soon as I sat in my seat in economy class, one of the flight attendants stopped and turned to me and said, are you Ajahn Brahm? And I said, last time I checked, yes. And she put her hand on her heart and said, I'm your biggest fan. I read all your books. Thank you so much for coming on my flights. And I knew from that time on, I would get very good in flight service. And during the flight, after they'd served the meal, they finally, please can you come to the galley where all the flight attendants, you know, hang out. And there, every one of the flight attendants was standing in line for photo. The photo op. And as they were taking turns, taking photographs with me, the lights were buzzing because of many Australians on that flight were buzzing for another can of beer. And then when they weren't getting answered because the flight attendants were busy taking photographs with me, one of them shouted, hey, give us a beer. After taking photographs with the monk. So when I was finished, all these Australians were glaring at me. It was wonderful, it was fun. I built a sense of community, even with Indonesians. And last March, for some people who have Islamophobia, the Muslims are exactly the same as us, especially over in Indonesia. Because I had to do a book signing after a big talk, about 3,000 or 4,000 people, and they had to line up to get the book signed. Many were Muslims with the hijab on, the veil on. And then this one young Muslim girl came up to get her book signed. And she was so excited. I was one of her heroes. And so when I signed her book, she lost it. You know what lost it means? Forgot where she was and what she was supposed to say. And actually what she actually said was, oh shit, he's signing my book. Oh shit. She was so excited. I don't know if Muslims are supposed to say that. I know monks are not to say that.
but I'm just repeating what she said. She was so excited, exactly the same, an excited young woman seeing one of her heroes and getting her books creating a sense of community, even with the Muslims over in Indonesia. Something I'm really, really proud of. Even some of the talks on YouTube. We know where they go because people have an opportunity to ask questions. And we see there's a question here coming in from Syria. We've had questions coming from Syria, from Iran. Places where I cannot go. No Buddhist monk will be allowed through the airport there. But still, these talks can go anywhere, creating this beautiful sense of community. How can we actually do this, sir? Aren't all these religions different? Of course they are. How can they live in harmony? And to answer that question, there was a story, and I like telling stories because this is how you remember the Dharma. If I say the Dharma, live in harmony, yeah, but you don't know how to do it because there's no story built around the teachings so that you can remember it. And this is a story of the old man and the violin. It's in my first book. And anyone wants to repeat this in interfaith meetings, it's the best. There was once an old man who lived way in the mountains, away from the city and the town, a very simple farming life. Those from Sri Lanka, you know, up in the mountains, in the rural parts, people just farm all day and they don't eat. Some people don't even have a television. In some countries they don't even have electricity. So remote. But the farmer worked really hard to give his kids an education. Just like some of your fathers did. Sacrifice because their life was given to their children. And their children lived up to their father's sacrifices, studied hard, went to university, and that was really hard for their father to pay the bills, but he did it, and eventually got good jobs in the city. And one day when they were meeting together, all his children, they thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to invite our father to the city for the first time? And so they decided to do that. They clubbed together, and they said, Dad, come. We'll look after you. We want to show you what a city is like. And so when the father came to the city, he'd never seen a city ever before. I'm going to go off on a little tangent first. Because in the city, one day they took him into a supermarket. Now, he'd never seen a supermarket ever before. He couldn't believe what they have in there. He went into the supermarket and he could see instant mashed potatoes. Just add hot water to the powder and you get instant mashed potatoes. He said, this is amazing. Because where I come from, in the village, we have to dig the earth, plant the seeding potatoes, wait for them to grow, harvest them, and then I have to wash them, boil them, and then I can mash them. This is so amazing in the city. Just powder, add water, and you get instant mashed potatoes. That's incredible. They went to another aisle, powdered milk. Milk powder. Just add water and you get milk. And he thought, where I come from, you have to find a cow, pull its teeth with a bucket underneath. That's the only way. And sometimes a cow kicks you. That's what we have to do to get milk. This is incredible in the city. But then what he saw in the next aisle really blew his mind. He thought, wow, these people in the city are so smart. Baby powder. In the village, we have to find a wife and take 9 months before we got a baby. But here, just add water and you get baby. Baby powder. That's a joke. But anyway, back to the real story. He was walking, not by the supermarket, but outside. And he heard the most terrible sound in the whole world. Screech, scratch, screech. It was terrible to hear. Worse than karaoke. In my life, that's the worst sound I've ever heard in the world. Karaoke.
so bad because this was late at night, everyone was drunk. I now think there is a hell for bad people. It's called the karaoke hell, where you have to learn people who don't know how to sing all day and all night hopeless songs, the karaoke hell. And I wouldn't wish that on anyone. Guantanamo Bay, if they really want to torture people, forget about waterboarding, karaoke will turn you crazy in one day. But anyway, back to terrible noise, but he was curious. He had to know what was making the sound. So he followed it to a source, and what did he find? A young boy playing a violin. I met about 6 or 7 years of age. Now, this was a man with hardly any education. He'd never seen or heard a violin ever before. So he came to the conclusion all violins sound like that. He never wanted to hear a violin ever again. So, next day, different part of town, he heard a beautiful sound. It was thrilling and sweet and just so sonorous. He had to find out what this was. He followed the beautiful music to its source, and you already know what the source was. It was a violin. But this time, being played by a woman about 70 or 75 years of age, she was a maestro. She'd been practicing the violin all her life, and my goodness, she could play it so sweetly. And then he realized his mistake. It was not the violin's fault. It is, you can't even blame the boy. He was just starting to learn the instrument. But once he heard a maestro playing the violin, he realized how sweet a violin can be. He knew his mistake. And here he thought, sometimes it's the same with religion. Sometimes you can blame this religion or that religion, this philosophy or that philosophy. A lot of times it's because you've never learned to see a maestro yet playing the religion. But the next day, he heard a sound which surpassed by a long way the maestro playing the violin. It was the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard in his life. Much more soothing than the sound of the wind in the forest up in the mountains. Much more delightful than the sound of the winter streams rushing over the pebbles in the stream bed, and even more delightful than the dawn chorus of the birds up in the mountains. It was the most beautiful thing he'd ever heard in his life. We had to find the source. Do you know what that was? An orchestra. And it was the most beautiful sound for two reasons. First, everyone playing their different instruments had learned their instruments so well, they were an individual maestro of their instrument. And number two, they learned to play together in harmony. And that's when he said, the most beautiful sound in the world is when people of all the different types of religion first of all learn how to play your faith well, and afterwards, please play in harmony all again. That is the most beautiful music in the world. That gives us hope. There's no way in the world we're going to convert everyone to being a Buddhist. I've often thought of that, because, you know, part of my job, you know, as a Buddhist monk, is to increase the number of Buddhists. Do you want to change it over? No. Part of my job is to, you know, spread the Dhamma. That's our job, set by the Buddha. It's so hard going all over the world, teaching here, teaching there, trying to convince people how beautiful the Dhamma is. So I have a plan. Go to the top. Go to the head. My goal in the next few years of my life is to convert the Pope. Once I've converted the Pope, not only do I get about 5 billion new Buddhists, Catholics, and then I also get the Vatican, which can be our great central Buddhism in Rome,
We're looking for a place for the bhikkhunis. That's the Abhidhamma Bhikkhuni project. Trying to find a place where bhikkhunis can actually live in London or in England. But there's no place for bhikkhunis right now. So I have all these cathedrals, all these churches, you have many, many viharas. The Vatican will be changed to the Vatican Vihara as well. We have the 10th Buddhist Vihara, now we have the Rogue Buddhist Vihara, the Vatican. And all these people and all this money. So that's what happens if you go to the top. That's ridiculous, isn't it? I like telling funny stories like that just to show how ridiculous they are. No, we have to, we never do that. We have to learn how to live in harmony and peace with one another, respect one another. You know, on that topic, this is for Buddhists, I was at a conference once in Australia, and I was presenting, you know, spirituality together. Now, in conferences, we have sections. We have one or two speakers. There's only two speakers in this section, myself and the abbot of a Benedictine monastery, a Catholic monk. And we've met each other many times before and had really good discussions. As a leading Buddhist, I make a point of actually seeking out people from other religions. Because I know if all I ever meet is other Buddhists, I can get very narrow-minded. So I want to meet other people to get more input. So I make sure I'm not bigoted and narrow-minded. And that's so important. So anyway, I sought out this abbot. Had great discussions together, but during our question time at this section of the conference, a gentleman stood up in the back and asked the question, what do Buddhists think of God? And you may have got that question yourself from some of your friends. And the person who was asking, I recognized him. If you were an Australian, you would know his name, Father Frank Brennan. He was an intellectual, highly regarded by the government, so much that he was appointed by the former Prime Minister, I think it was Tony Abbott, appointed by him to head a panel to introduce more human rights clauses into the Australian Constitution. He was a highly regarded intellectual. So when he asked me that question, what's the Buddhist idea of God? I knew I could not tell a joke. This was a heavyweight question. So I had to think quickly. And on this occasion, I did rise to the occasion. If I did rise to the occasion, I wouldn't repeat it to you now. And what I told him, I said, this was without any preparation. My friend sitting next to me here, Abbot Placid, we've had long conversations for many, many years. Unfortunately, he died a couple of years ago. You know what happened? We knew, or the whole monastery and the Catholic community knew we were such good friends. I was invited to his funeral mass. I was the only non-Catholic there, and I was invited up to give a little speech. So I was realizing that Catholic community in Western Australia had recognized I was his friend. And they invited me to come up. Creating goodies, which was so important in our modern world. A sense of spiritual community, way beyond just Buddhists. So anyway, my answer was, my friend over here, he's been telling me for years that one of his basic beliefs is that everybody is searching for God. Now, don't question that yet, because one of the ways to create a sense of community is respecting one another, even if you don't agree with them. Respecting each other's perspective. And so I respect, this is my friend. We've had such wonderful trust together that I'm going to not challenge his belief, respect it, and try and understand it. So, I was a Buddhist. So, what am I searching for? What are each one of you searching for? Because everyone's supposed to be searching for God. I'm searching for, and you're searching for peace. For respect. Everybody in this world, gay, lesbian, transgender, and pop, when you're not respected,
when you're not valued. We're speaking for respect, love, because that's part of the sense of community, to be able to give love and to receive it from your friends, your family. That's what we're seeking. A sense of fulfillment in whatever career, the ability to serve and give to others, which is such an important part of our life. Those are the things which people are searching for, especially Buddhists. So, you said everyone is searching for God, and that's what we're searching for. That must mean what God is to a Buddhist. Peace. To love and receive love. To respect. Have a sense of fulfillment. The opportunity to serve others. That is the Buddhist idea of God. Where one searches for. And as Father Van Velde said, wow! I never expected that. I expected you to say Buddhists don't believe in God. That would have just created a wall between us. Now we take the whole thing far deeper, more meaningful, to create harmony and bridges between people. Because everybody could believe in that God. Because it doesn't belong to anybody or any religion. Which means it's something which creates a community which is not divided. Well, so those are wonderful things which create a lovely sense. It's wisdom seen deeper which creates that sense of community. The other thing which creates a sense of spiritual community is not just the wisdom, and seen deeper, which overcomes the things which divide us, but actually being able to put this into practice. It's not just intellectual. Yeah, we can think, oh yeah, that sounds good, but we don't do anything about it. It stays in our head and doesn't go down to our heart. Sometimes it's hanging out with one another creates a sense of community. That's why I say just having a cup of tea together after the talk, not rushing off afterwards, making friends with one another. And I found that so wonderful, so great, not just your family, but everybody. Because when you can make those connections, there's something which rubs off on you. Now, you know that I've been an author of many books, and they have really done well. In Germany, earlier this year, that one of my books, which is in America, is called Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. Some people know it's good, bad, who knows. The Deutsche title, because all these books get translated, different titles in different countries, and actually they can choose whatever they wish to call it. So the German title actually means The Elephant Who Lost His Happiness. That's the title. And that reached number 3 across the nation on the bestseller list of all books, romance, sci-fi, everything. It got to number 3, which I was very amazed at. In fact, the company, the publisher, which was Random House in Germany, they sent emails to me, can I come to Germany straight away? I had many invitations on the late night talk shows in Germany, which is where you get phenomena they would like to interview. But I said, look, number one, I can't speak Deutsch. Number 2, I've got no time. Number 3, I can't afford the ticket. Forget it. So I never went. But it's amazing. It was actually received so well. And also, I wondered why they chose that particular title relating to only one of the 108 stories in that book. Because those authors, those publishers, noticed this was a powerful story, the one which stood out for them. And that particular story goes like this. It's actually based on a Buddhist Jataka tale. And it was the story of an elephant, a royal elephant. Now, in those days, some of you may remember from your history books in Sri Lanka, even in Thailand, if you understand just the jungles, the rainforests in those parts of the world, a car or a bicycle or a motorbike is hopeless. The main means of transport in those days, it was not a horse, and the horses were in Europe, elephants. And the elephants of a king were like the Rolls Royces and Porsches. To get a good elephant was like getting a Ferrari. So only the kings could afford the best elephants. So the king's prize elephant was pampered, just like you would pamper a Lamborghini. So, the elephant was pampered, looked after, well fed, but one day the elephant started to misbehave. Just when the trainer was standing behind him, that was when the elephant did a poo. Now, elephant poo is a lot, so you have to make sure you're well clear of an elephant when it does its business. And this was a personal experience of mine. Now, those who are in Sri Lanka know this. I go to Sri Lanka a lot. I'm highly regarded there. And one day before a talk I was to give in Kandy, in a university there, they did a perihara, a procession, where they had the elephant right in front. I had to stand behind in a procession. And I was very, very worried. I made sure there was enough spaces behind. You know, just like you must never drive close to the car in front of you in case the car in front of you stops suddenly. I wasn't afraid of bumping into the elephant because it stopped suddenly. I was really concerned that it pooed, or even worse, farted. Because there's so much wind in an elephant, that would have probably knocked me out. So I don't like going in processions behind elephants in Sri Lanka, okay? It's very dangerous. I'm sure it's happened a few times. But this particular elephant would do that on purpose. Not only that, you know, elephants sucking water in their trunk, and they would even douse the king when he came past. Before, the elephant was really well behaved. And they were like, what's gone up with the elephant? So they got a doctor out, a vet, to check the elephant. Nothing wrong. The elephant was a female, so they thought it might be PMS. But it wasn't, that was only a joke. I'm going to get into trouble for that. But they couldn't find nothing wrong with the elephant. So this is a Jataka tale, and you know the Jataka tales, there's always a minister who's to be the Buddha in the future. They got this minister, he said, I'll look after this. So what the minister did, that evening, after work, you know, he took some sandwiches or whatever, and he stayed all night by the elephant stall, just to check out what happened. And about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, that minister heard a sound, a noise behind the elephant stall. And he crept through the bushes to investigate. And what he found, that right behind the elephant stall was a meeting place of a gang of thieves, of drug dealers. And they would meet behind the elephant stall to discuss who they were going to rob that night, who they were going to beat up for not paying their drug debts, and where they were going to sell or distribute or find more drugs. A group of really bad people. And he knew straight away why the elephant had become bad. Because even though the elephant could not understand human speech, still the elephant picked up on the bad vibes, if you like to call it that, of the people right behind the elephant's stall. And that was what had turned the elephant into being bad. So the solution now you know the problem, was easy. The solution was arresting those drug dealers the following night and replacing them with monks, or these days, with bhikkhunis. And every night those monks, or some nights bhikkhunis, would meditate, would discuss the Dharma, chant some pyrrhics, and even though that elephant could not understand the Pyrrhic chanting, as many of you cannot understand Pyrrhic chanting. It's not in Pali, not in English, not even in Sinhala. And there's a good reason for that. I'll tell you the reason. Because once, you know, I work really hard. Sometimes I get tired. And I was doing
some chanting, some blessing for a wedding. This couple who I've seen so often, they'd come to the temple a lot. They were getting married and they wanted a blessing from the monk. So I gave the blessing, some pyrrhic chanting. When I did pyrrhic chanting, I made a mistake. I did the funeral chant for them. Are they getting married? But they didn't understand Pali. Sadhu, what a wonderful chanting. They were so thankful, they gave a donation for the temple. And you know, I never told them. Oops. I never told them that it was like a funeral chance. Amazing though, they're still together. But that is why we chant in a foreign language. Because then the monks can make mistakes and you'll never find out. On that subject of chanting, this also happened to me last year. I like telling stories about these things. Last year, there was a Chinese Buddhist man who was really so sick. He was taken to hospital. They made him to ICU to die. He was that sick, only a few days left. And the family came from like Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong, I forget where, or even from mainland China, to be with their father, grandfather, uncle for his last few days. And one of them asked me, "Ajahn Brahm, can you please come and chant for our father, grandfather, uncle, who's dying in the ICU?" I am a very kind monk. I would do anything. And I stopped whatever I was doing, went to the hospital, got into the ICU, and had energy that day. So I gave this poor person really superpower chanting. I gave it everything I've got. And I've got lots of energy when I want to use it. I really gave it to him, I zapped him, I empowered him with my chanting. And it worked. It actually worked. He started to recover. And he actually, a few days later, he was taken out of the ICU, put in an ordinary ward. My chanting stopped him dying. And that's when I got into big trouble. Because a family scolded me. Ajahn Brahm, we'd already arranged the funeral. We'd all come from overseas for his funeral. We wanted you to chant for a peaceful death, not to recover. Now we've got to all go home and come back in a couple of weeks later and arrange a new funeral. That's not what we wanted, Ajahn Brahm. I made a mistake again, the wrong chanting. But it was really their fault because they never told me. So now, whenever I go to do some, please remember this, Venables, whenever you go to do some chanting in the hospital, please ask the family what type of chanting they want. Die peacefully chanting or get better chanting. And I'm telling you, it's very powerful, don't make a mistake. If you tell them to do the wrong type of chanting, it's your fault. If you just want them to get better and we do the die peacefully chanting, if they die, it's not my fault. But that's actually a true story. Sometimes the best stories you can't make up. But then that's why we do the chanting in a foreign language, so you don't know what we're up to. Anyway, so they did the chanting, but even though the elephant didn't understand the words, still got the meaning, the feeling, the energy, the goodness, the kindness of good people being so close. And a few days later, the elephant's bad behavior totally disappeared. Became a really good, probably better than before. Because this is how we change characters. Association. Osmosis. You all know that Pali chant? It's part of the Magna Sutta. Asewana Chabala, Nam Paditana, Chasewana. Don't associate with bad people, associate with good ones. It actually works, it changes you. For that reason, there's many, many people. Many wives send their husbands to the monastery when they misbehave. Now don't think that all men who come to stay in a monastery are misbehaving husbands. That's not true, only some of them. And they do that because associating with the monks, hanging out with them, is just like the monks and the elephants. You actually change, you become much better.
So people love sending them back to the monastery. They come back new, improved versions. Sometimes they send the wives to the monastery. They come back so nice and easy going. They don't complain anymore. They've got this from hanging out with the monks. We actually do get osmosis. The problem is, when you send these angry wives and these lazy husbands to the monastery, sometimes it rubs off on the monks. And we but no, we're much stronger, far greater resources, so we can withstand that. But that association with one another, if good people don't associate with some bad people, it doesn't actually rub off, and their harmony doesn't actually happen. So to create a sense of spiritual community, sometimes it's great. If you're in any difficulty, depressed, hang out with non-depressed people. Don't just stay in your room. Come to a temple. Come to a place where there's good, kind, generous people. Because that is one of the best ways of overcoming that negativity. Just like the elephant. Now that sense of community, you only find in organizations such as this, the Tenth Buddhist Vihara, or the other Buddhist temples, or other really kind groups. Which is one of the reasons why you come here. Not just to listen to the Dhamma, not just to meditate, not just to, what else do you come here for? To do the precepts or the Dhamma or this other stuff, listen to Purichati. Even if you don't come here, because that actually does change you. The community, the sense of fellowship, the sense of being with kind people is great. Even like seeing people you can trust inspires you. It's wonderful when there's people you can trust so much, you can leave your purse somewhere and you know it's going to be there, you know, when you're up, you've gone to the toilet. Some places you do that and it's gone after 1 or 2 minutes. Because people who come to temples do keep 5 precepts. You don't take what's not given. We look after people's property. And we want other people to look after our property. So that's inspiring. And that gives you so much peace and confidence in the goodness in this world. Once you see that goodness, it's incredible and wonderful. One of the other stories of just how being with good people, kind people, has huge effects in one's life. It's one of my favourite stories, which is also in the Don't Worry Be Grumpy book. There was a woman in the United States, elderly woman, had a very severe and rare and aggressive form of cancer. And her doctor, her specialist, said, I can't treat this. It is too aggressive, too rare. And so he referred it to another doctor, referred it to another doctor, referred it to another. No one wanted to take it on. Until he got to one doctor in New York, one oncologist, who looked over that report and said, I will take this one on. No one else would do it because they thought it was a hopeless case. This one doctor in New York said, I will do this. And this doctor literally threw every resource he had at treating this patient, calling in favors from specialists on the other side of the United States, giving every modern state-of-the-art treatment to try and get rid of this aggressive cancer in this poor elderly woman. He put so much of his time and energy into treating her, it actually worked. And he could tell her she was in remission, that the death sentence had been reprieved. It was such an amazing thing he had done. But a few days later, after returning home, knowing she would live, this poor elderly woman received an envelope from the hospital, the bill. Now, many of you know, the United States doesn't have a national health system. If you want to get that sort of treatment, you have to pay for it. Not just small money, 6 figures, sometimes 7-figure numbers in dollars. People actually lose their homes
They have to sell their homes and all their properties and everything else in the United States to pay their bills. So when this old lady opened the envelope, she was shaking in fear. How am I going to be able to afford this? But on the bill, there's something written on there which made her weep. Before I tell you what those words were, you have to go back 30 years. When that specialist was a young medical student from a poor family trying to pay his way through medical school. And the only, this is apparently a true story. The only way he could pay his way was getting jobs. Any jobs, rough jobs. And one of those jobs was selling things door to door. One of the worst jobs in the world. But I say, I did that job once. This is interesting about guilt and forgiveness. I'm going off on a tangent again. I love tangents because I keep you in suspense about the main story. I was selling things once door to door as a student because by this time my father had died, my mother was poor, really hard actually to pay my way, selling children's encyclopedias door to door. And it was a scam. Those encyclopedias weren't worth it. They were rubbish. But I wouldn't get any money unless I sold one. And so one day I said, right, I'm going to use all my marketing skills. And I sold one. This young family had just given birth to a kid. And I made them feel with this argument that they were depriving their newly born child of a real education. They were putting their kid behind all the other kids if they didn't buy this really essential book for your kid's education. I made them feel just one step higher than the paedophile if they did not buy this book. Really working on their guilt. And they bought it. And afterwards, that night, I hardly slept. I felt so bad, so guilty. And I felt guilty about... next day, I gave up that job. I could find another job, anything, but not selling rubbish to these poor people who just given birth to a child. You know how expensive that is, looking after the kid. Just, you know, using, you know, exploiting their excitement and their love for their kid and their guilt. So I resigned from that job the next day. Well, I lived with that guilt for years. What had I done? That was not right. That was terrible. And I told that story about guilt one evening in Perth on a Friday night talks. You can't make up these stories. After I told that story about, you know, this is guilt, I forgave myself, sort of, but actually not totally. You may think it's a small thing, but for me it was big. I felt terrible. And this woman came up. She was maybe about 25, 30. And she said, this is unbelievable, but it happened. When I was newly born, my parents told me a young man came to our door with long hair and a beard and sold us his encyclopedia. And he said, it's just too much of a coincidence. It must be true. I loved that book. That was my favourite book for years. I had that next to the bed. It was my beautiful book. And that turned my guilt totally around. I thought it was rubbish. But she said it was her favourite book. Was it me? I reckon it was. That's how the world works. So that totally overcame my guilt. So this guy was selling stuff door to door. He probably felt guilty, but that's the only thing he could do. And it's really hard. Knocking on a door, go away. Knocking on a door, dog runs after you. Knocking on a door, they come out with a bucket of water to try and throw at you. That's what he's like, selling things door to door. And this poor guy was getting all of that all day, hot summer afternoon in New York. Knock on another door, man, no! But the woman said, hang on a moment. Young man, have you had anything to eat today yet? And he said, absolutely not, actually. I've not since this morning. I've been knocking on doors all day. It's mid-afternoon. Wait a few moments, young man. And this woman, a youngish woman, came back with a glass of milk and two cookies, the biscuits in the United States. Have these, young man. And he so gratefully drank that milk, because he was so thirsty, and just ate those two biscuits to give a bit of energy to carry on until dinner. Thank you. So 30 years forward, when that old lady opened that envelope, inside it read, paid 30 years ago with a glass of milk and two cookies. True story. He'd taken on that case, because when he read the address of this woman, it rang a bell. There was a house. He checked that that woman had not moved. It was the same woman who had helped 30 years ago. That is why he took on that case. That is why he gave it everything he got, what no other doctor would ever do. Calling in favours, pushing anything impossible. He was going to cure that lady, and he did. When it came to the bill, paid 30 years ago. It's a simple act of kindness. That is spiritual community. That is kindness. A little act, you think, doesn't mean anything at all. Simple for you, but changes everything. So I get a bit emotional when I say that, because it's beautiful, it's inspiring. So, never ever think that $1 is not going to change the world. Never think that just stopping to help someone who's broken down by the side of the road is not going to pay off all your debts. Never ever think kindness doesn't work. It is the kindness which is the biggest thing which creates a spiritual community. Kind to one another. Simple things. You know that I have too many disciples. Way too many. And one of the reasons why is I'm really going to try and be out of my way to be kind to everyone. Even though I'm exhausted. Simple things like, you know, I'm a very 42 years, really well known, senior monk. And sometimes I will open the door for you. Go through here, Ramsey. You've seen me do that before. Don't do that. I'm not supposed to do that. I'm senior. You're supposed to respect me. Sit down. You don't have to stand up when you ask me questions. That's a kindness. That creates a bond. Never, ever, just because, you know, you're senior, because that you are the boss of a company, because that, you know, this our custom says I shouldn't do this. Kindness overcomes all rules. So never ever push aside an act of kindness. That is what creates a beautiful community. Your family, please be kind to one another. Fact or little story, which I've told many times on this little tour so far. And this, because this is also meets this thing about when you're kind to something, it always comes back to you. We have a community, all a community. Some of you I've seen last year, years before. Some of you I've known many years. In my temple, because I've been in that temple in Western Australia 33 years now. I've seen kids, they come up with their mum when they're that size. And they grow up with me. They pray in the temple. They make a mess, they make a noise, but they're welcome. Because later on they feel this is their home. They feel comfortable here. They won't be afraid of the monks, the handlers, because they've seen you before. And then when they have a trouble at school, you know, you give them some good advice. Even if it's just some chanting. Chanting works. It's very similar to you're at the football stadium and you're chanting for your team. Of course it works. Even at that level, you're encouraging them. Come on, you can do it. That's why we chant at weddings. Come on, you can make it work. You need that encouragement. It can be done. So, anyway, we chant for them,
when they go to university, they have boyfriend, girlfriend troubles, you know. Amazing, they come to a monk for advice on that. Amazing, I've never been married, but I did have girlfriends and stuff, so you know a bit about this. So you encourage them. How can I find a girlfriend? I'm really lonely, someone I really like. I tell them all the tips. It's amazing how many tips I have. How can I find a boy? And it's really cute. I actually really enjoy that because these little people are like my godchildren. Just like you have your children, you want them to be happy, you want them to find a girlfriend, a boyfriend, to be happy, be socially sort of well adjusted. So when that happens, I feel so happy. Yeah, he agreed to go out with me. I actually feel good about that. Anyway, and then when they go to university, they start their career, you're a friend. That extra piece in the community, which I can tell them things that mum and dad can never tell them, and give them advice which their counselors at university can never give them. Anyway, this particular man, this Sri Lankan boy, really smart, went to medical school, graduated, became a doctor. Really successful, except in his first year, he came to see me, devastated. He said, I'm going to have to find another career. Something happened this afternoon which has shaken me and made me think I cannot continue to be a doctor. In his hospital, he was in charge of one patient, and the patient died tragically. Even though no one could really blame him, he felt so guilty. What made it worse, it was a young woman, maybe about 24, 25, died, and he had to be the one who told the husband, you have no more wife, and watched the husband break down and sob. He loved his wife. It just recently 4 or 5 years marriage, and the bloom of love, and worse, to tell the husband his 2 small children had no mother. That cut him up so deeply, he said, I can't do that ever again. I can't take, the hurt which I see in these people I have to tell. I'm going to have to change my career. I'm a failure. And that was when I told this man, I've known him since he was born, I said, you've misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor. Being a doctor is not to cure people. If you think that's the purpose of being a doctor or a nurse or a psychiatrist or a psychologist or whatever other healing profession you have, if you think it's to cure people, you will fail many times. Obviously, there's people who you cannot prevent them from dying. You cannot prevent them from their mental illness carrying on. You cannot cure it. If you think your job is to cure, you will fail many times and get very depressed. Your job is not to cure. Your purpose in life as a doctor, or in any of those caring professions, is, as I said, to care. As a doctor, your purpose is to care for your patients, not to cure them. And if that's your main purpose, you never ever need to fail. You can always care for a person, even though they die. You can always care for a schizophrenic, even if you cannot cure the schizophrenia. You can always care for your husband, even if you can't cure him. Your job is to care. You never need to fail. And it changes the whole situation. If somebody dies, know they'll be cared for. If that's your grandma who dies, and you know she's been cared for so well, it takes away some of the pain of separation. A lot of it. And so number one, you never need to fail. And also, you'll probably be surprised. I think you all know intuitively, if you make caring more important than curing, more people will survive the illnesses. Your cure rate will increase. He got it straight away. Went back to work, became a specialist. And he comes regularly to say thank you, to offer dharma, to offer the food to the monks, do donations. Always say, this is my philosophy now. I don't try and cure patients, I care for them. That's number one. If curing happens, that's a bonus. And he became a great specialist. And it happened a couple of months ago. One of the monks at my monastery in Perth, of 22 monks there, one of them told me that he'd been, blood was coming out of his anus. All his feces were liquid. It had been happening for a couple of months, he hadn't told me. Go straight to the doctor. Any doctors here know that's probably a sign of colon cancer. When his doctor heard, why hadn't you come here earlier? And sent him to get an endoscopy as soon as possible. We do have in Australia a government medical system called Medicare. He tried to do it on Medicare. We may be able to fit you in 6 weeks. So he came back and said, 6 weeks. I said, that is not good enough. Go private. Private costs a lot of money. But how much does a life cost? It probably would be colon cancer. So get it to endoscopy as soon as possible. So he went private. You know the doctor he got? My student. The guy I taught how to care, not to cure. Now a specialist in bowels. What do they call that, a bowel specialist? A shit specialist? I don't know. And so as soon as he saw it, it was one of my disciples, he got his extra straight away, the next possible opening, fast track, no charge, because this is one of my friends that helped him with his career. He wouldn't be a doctor if it wasn't for me. So no charge, I said, well, I'll come off it. And of course, it was good. It was only just an irritation of the bowel, no cancer. I was very, very lucky. But it was wonderful, that little bit of kindness, and actually saved the monastery a lot of money. By giving him fast track, treatment. That's what community is. You show little kindnesses to one another, and you will help one another. Then people sometimes ask me about insurance. How much does it cost to insure your house, your possessions, your health? And I know that these days, economic problems, sometimes the insurance company does not pay out. They find a loophole somewhere. You know you cannot trust savings in banks? They go bust. The stock market crashes. Whatever it is, the housing bubble bursts. You know what happens? Where can you invest things knowing they'll be there for you when you really need them? With community. Being kind to one another. Caring for people in your family. Your friends. People you work with. That is your best insurance policy. Because when you need help, your friends will be there for you. Caring for you. Helping you. Giving you a place to stay. If you've been chucked out of the house by your wife. Giving you some help financially if you really get into difficulty. Coming to see you in hospital, trying to cheer you up. Taking your children to the hospital because you and the driver are in the bed. Community. Building community is the best insurance in the world because it never goes bust. It's reliable. So when you build a spiritual, kind community, wherever you are in this world, that is what we rely on in times of difficulty. And we never, ever need to be worried or concerned. They will be there for us. As for me, my community is worldwide. I don't have medical insurance wherever I go. Okay, I'm in England now, so I will get NHS, and I've still got my British passport. But I go to other countries. United States, Singapore, Malaysia, Korea. I don't need medical insurance. I've got so many doctors I've helped, so many nurses, psychologists, that is only psychologists, I'll teach them, but doctors, who respect and love me, that when I do get sick, there's a fight. No, I will pay the bill. No, I will pay the bill. No, I'm going to pay the bill for that health bar. No, it's my turn. That did fight to try and look after me. I've got about 5 or 6 dentists who are just waiting for my teeth to get ill. Come and see me. Please, 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 please. I need to make some noise. Actually, on that subject, one of the dentists, I had a cracked tooth once. And so there's no option, he had to remove it. And I didn't know this, he just removed it. And what did they do with old teeth? This dentist, who's a patient, he kept it in a jar. Because he told me, he said, if ever I get short of cash, he'll become a relic. And I can say that. That's what he thought. To sell the tooth of a famous monk. But that bad karma trying to take some of my bodily parts and keep them there. So you know what happened to him? He moved office and he lost it. He can't find it. Be very careful messing around with good monks. Have bad intentions. Things sometimes disappear. So anyway, that's a true story. That was strange. Anyway. Anyway, I don't need that because the kindness means everyone will be there to help me. And hopefully that's the same for you. You've got friends, colleagues. You've created a community. You've created a family which goes way beyond your blood. Friends who love and care for you. A community who will be there for you in times of difficulty and struggle. When the health service has no beds. When the insurance company says, well, I'm sorry, this is a loophole, we cannot pay. When anything else seems to fail you, community will always be there. Really, it is our first resource, not really our last. But to finish off with, on insurance. There is one of my friends over in Sydney. And he had quite a big house. And he was paying a fortune on his insurance, house insurance, property insurance. And the insurance policy insisted he had CCTV cameras installed, really big locks on his doors, security screens on his windows, which made him look like he was in a prison. And they would not give him insurance, or at least charge an enormous amount of money if he did not do that. Do we have similar policies in London? Yeah. Yeah, okay. But he said, no, this is far too expensive. And he was a very smart guy. He found this amazing way. First, he paid no insurance at all and get free surveillance. What he did, very cheaply, maybe about $100, actually less than that, maybe $50, what's that, about £30? He went to the woodyard, got a pole, put it in his garden, and on the top of his pole, he put an ISIS flag. Now, he had 24/7 surveillance by the Federal Police of Australia, by the Secret Service of Australia, he's the CIA over there. He's the surveillance 24/7 without paying a cent. Smart guy. Thank you for listening. Okay, any questions on today's talk on building a community with kindness, spiritual community? Okay. Are you inspired and encouraged?
Yes.
Would you like me to come more often?
Yes.
Is that possible?
Yes.
That's not. So the only way I can do this is actually creating more good monks. Is that really possible?
Yes.
Can't we create twice as many good spiritual leaders?
Yes.
women.
That is why I'm coming here, because to create bhikkhunis, to double the sangha. It's very hard to get enough monks. How many? Is it hard to get monks to come to this temple? There's only a certain pool. How about doubling the pool? Having women come. That's why I am here, to try and get a place for bhikkhunis here in England, a place they can stay, a little place to start off with, so women can ordain, become teachers themselves, doubling the sangha, to create a larger spiritual community for the benefit of everyone. Not only that, as I said to the few of the committee, you're over there now, said to a few people earlier, that is historic. For those of you from Sri Lanka, you know what are the historic moments in Buddhism? Not just in the Buddha's birth, under the Bodhi tree, the first sermon and death, but you also know when the Arahant Mahinda first came to Sri Lanka. It's a historic moment which everyone remembers. You remember when Sanghamitta brought the Bodhi tree over to Sri Lanka, Bhikkhuni? Historic. You know when, even here, Anagarika Dhammapada first started the temple over in Chiswick, big problem there. These are historic moments in Buddhism. And you are incredibly lucky to be witnessing another historic moment. Bhikkhunis, female fully ordained nuns, being restored into the Buddhist tradition. Lost for many centuries. Your grandparents, great-grandparents would not see this. You now start to see them. This is history, Buddhist history, being made in your lifetime. That is why when I see what I'm doing to try and promote this, I get goosebumps. I know my Buddhism. I know my Buddhist history. This is really special. It's happening all over the world. It should happen here in England too. There'll be statues made. I told the committee you're looking after Alan Camper, you're likely to get your photos in books. I'm not exaggerating. Sorry, Sister Chanda, you too. When the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree, just enlightened. Mara, you know Mara, he was like the tempter, the bad guy in Buddhism. Trying to convince the Buddha not to teach. Yeah, okay, I can see you're enlightened, but please don't make any more people wise. And the Buddha replied, I will not stop. I will not leave this world until I have established four communities. Until I've established the community of bhikkhus. Until they're well-learned, well-trained, well-experienced, well-attained. That's number one. Number two, the community of bhikkhunis, female monks, fully ordained. Until they are numerous, enlightened, fully attained, numerous. Until I've established the group of female monastic, female lay people, they call the Upasikas, and male followers, the Upasikas, many attain numerous. When I have done that, then I will enter Parinibbana. I will leave this world. 45 years later, at the Chapala shrine outside Visali, Mara came to see the Buddha again. Say, you have completed your mission. There are so many enlightened good bhikkhus, so many enlightened, wonderful, inspiring bhikkhunis, so many great upasikas, this is the white robe lay men, so many great lay women following Buddhism. You've achieved your mission, your goal. Now, leave the world. And that's where the Buddha said, okay, in 3 months' time, I will leave Parinibbana. That's in the suttas.
That's, you can read that yourself. What that means is, was the Buddha's original mission an idea, an ideal? This is why he taught for it. We've lost one of those parts of Buddhism. When I read that, I thought, don't just sit there at your mom, do something to reinstate it. I am famous, I've got the disciples to raise money, you've got faith in me, so why not use this? So that's why I'm supporting this to the max. Whatever I support happens. I deliver. So this is going to happen. If you want to be a part of it, wow. It's making history. And I'm not just doing this as a salesman. I'm a monk, not a salesman. I'm not doing a marketing pitch. I'm just expressing the emotions, the truth in my heart. Please be a part of this. Thank you. So anyway, there should be some questions coming up through our Q&A. For those of you who are working tomorrow, haven't had anything to eat yet, if you need to leave, you will never upset me. Please, if you need to go, you're most welcome to go now because it's late for Thursday. If you wish to say please stay, because there's another half an hour on the program, I believe, 9:30, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, questions and answers, please. Or what I said this evening or anything else. Yes.
If we're talking about community, how do you cope with people that are against that? How do you cope with people that are always negative and against that?
Okay. You don't need the microphone, I'll repeat the question for you. When you're talking about making a community, how do you deal with people who are against community, who are negative towards that? You brainwash them. Basically. Suggestion. Because there's so much negativity in this world. People, oh, that won't work. Ah, oh, that's just stupid. Oh, you're just a religious nutcase, Ajahn. But what you actually do, you stand your ground and you keep on your path until you convince people. You don't convince people with your speech. You can convince people with your actions, with what you do, and how you do it. So actually, you take people who are negative, and you prove to them that they made a mistake. It is important, it does work. People who are so negative in this world have got so many disappointments, and sometimes they only see the disappointments in life. Key story, two bad bricks and a wall. Which I hope you all know, I've told you so many times in this temple here. In brief, I had to build a wall. No money, 33 years ago, building a monastery in Australia. I never built a wall before in my life. I was a theoretical physicist, not a labourer. So I was very careful, making sure every brick was fine. I took a huge amount of time. When I finished my first brick wall, only then, after the mortar was all rock hard, I noticed my two mistakes. Two bricks were crooked. All the rest of the bricks were horizontal. These two were so crooked they stood out. What am I going to do? I tried to scrape out the mortar. It was like rock. Cement mortar, after a day or two, you can't scrape it out at all. There was another man with me at the time, and I did actually ask him, have we got enough money to afford to buy some dynamite? I really wanted to blow up that wall so I could start again. That's an important part of this story. I wanted to destroy the wall because I couldn't stand it. Start again. Like many people try to destroy a relationship. Get rid of your partner. Start again. Because of negativity. It was only after 3 months. I had nightmares of that wall. I felt terrible about that wall. After 3 months, a man was with me. Saw that wall and said, that is a beautiful wall. And I couldn't believe what he said. When he said, beautiful wall, are you blind? I said, can't you see the two bad bricks, the two crooked bricks in the wall? And that man said something which changed a lot of my life and a lot of other people's lives, saved many marriages, got rid of so much negativity, cured cancers. Brilliant answer. He said, yes, I can see the two crooked bricks in the wall. But I can also see the 998 perfect bricks in the wall.
And at that, I realized I was the blind one. I've been blind for 3 months. Every time I saw that wall, my eyes went to the two forks. That's all I saw. When I thought of the wall, I thought of the crooked bricks. When I dreamed of the wall, crooked bricks. It was the first time in 3 months I saw the brick to the left, the brick to the right, above and below, and all the other really beautiful bricks I'd made. And I realized that was not just on that wall. Much of my life, my negativity was this habit of seeing the crooked bricks in the wall and being blind to the beautiful bricks in the wall. If you're having any trouble, and anyone here, trouble in relationships, it's only because you see the two crooked bricks in your partner. They're there. They're not the best part. They're not perfect. You've got crooked bricks in it. But you can't see the 998 beautiful bricks in your partner. If you are depressed, it's because all you ever see is the two crooked bricks in your life. You don't see the beautiful bricks in your life. All we need to do is have someone say, hey, what about all the beautiful, wonderful parts of you, the great things you've done in this world for others and for life? And you start seeing that, you find, wow, I'm not that bad. I am good enough. Actually, I'm pretty good. That wall is still there. Because I was told later on by a builder, every bricklayer makes mistakes. But in the building industry, this is in Australia, I'm sure it's the same here in the UK. In a building industry, if the builder makes mistakes like two crooked bricks in the wall, he tells you, the client, it is a feature, and charge you an extra couple of thousand pounds for it. No other house in London has a wall like this. It's artistic. See, those crooked bricks, they set off all the other bricks. And I thought, beautiful, because that is true. All the bad stuff in you, they're features of your life, where you grow. They make you unique and actually human. So you don't want to destroy your relationships anymore. You don't want to blow them up and get divorced and try it again. You don't want to blow yourself up and commit suicide, as so many people do. Last year I went to Hong Kong, the Chinese University in Hong Kong, because they had a whole series of suicides in their university. They knew I was a really good monk. They invited me there, the whole faculty, the senior faculty, they came to my talk, and I mentioned that story as I just told you. They were so impressed. Passed it around. And since I went there, and these are things which move me. I'm not just praising myself, I'm praising the story. Since I went and told them the story, there'd be no more suicides in that university. That makes me feel so good. You stop young people killing themselves. You stop people, young man and woman, from divorcing, from separating. They see the relationship in a totally different way. Anyone who's negative, try that story. Tell them. They realize there's not much to be negative about. There's also much to feel great about in yourself, in life, in the world, even in your governments. Newspapers only focus on the two bad bricks in the government. That's their job, which means we forget that you have a government which gives you so many freedoms and protects those freedoms. They're not the best, but they're trying their very best to create a good economy, jobs, good health for you. Could you do better? No. So please be generous and kind to people who help and serve. And if you look at your governments and your leaders with such kindness rather than negativity, you'll find they'll become better leaders and better governments. This is a psychological truth which I have noticed and exploited in my life. When you look at a person, sometimes I go to jails to see paedophiles, serial killers, rapists, and these are people the hardest to love. So I know I have to do that. Especially paedophiles, that's
the hardest task for you to succeed. How I do that? In seeing much more than the crime for which they've been put in jail. They are not a paedophile. They are a person who's done many paedophilic acts. They're not a rapist. They're a person who's raped. I see more of them, not just the 2 or 10 or 100 crooked bricks in the wall. When I see that, amazing thing happens. They see it as well. And I look for their goodness, their kindness, their beauty. They see it themselves. And then they show it back to me. You take these incredible, bastards that are such bad stuff. You turn them into saints. They see their goodness. And their goodness shines through. A lot of the times people do these things because they don't think they're worth anything. Give them a sense of worth. You see their goodness. They see it themselves. They're worth something. And then they change. That's how it works. So, a person is negative. You look at the other side of them, their good things. It's incredible how that can change them. Amazing. It really works. Okay, I spent a lot of time on that question.
Yes, blocked the...
Sorry?
Somebody has blocked the driveway, actually.
Oh, blocked the driveway.
Sorry, I'm not being negative here, but I think there's a Toyota car, LD08GYK. I think if you haven't moved that car as soon as possible, please. It's again LD08GYK Toyota car.
Because that car will be creating bad karma, and its next life will be reborn as a cycle, bicycle. It'll go down. Okay, so please move the car if you want to repair. Okay, come on, some other questions? I have an answer, yes.
Adam, do you ever complain?
Adam, do I ever complain? I only complain usually out of jokes. In other words, not seriously. Because complaining, look, complain, does anyone listen or take any action? Do you complain? So instead of complaining, there's another thing which I do, which comes from an old Chinese proverb, very easy. Instead of complaining about darkness, light a candle. So complaining is actually a waste of time. But yeah, you do complain sometimes, but then okay, right, let's do something about it. Light a candle. There's always something you can do. So people are going to complain about the government, about the war in Syria. Well, I might do something. People feel so they can't do anything at all. Of course you can. Tiny little things. Acts of kindness, acts of goodness. You don't have to think. Looking at a terrorist and seeing something more in them than their crazy worldview. It's a human being in there. It's a human being, I don't know why they do those crazy stuff. Maybe they're upbeat because of being brainwashed, I don't know. But there's a human being in there. See their beauty, touch them. They probably never want to grab anybody ever again. A terrorist story. I said this in my own book. This is one of the most beautiful Buddhist government stories. This was in Thailand when I was a young monk. Just after the Vietnam War, when Vietnam fell to the communists, and then Laos, and then Cambodia, the northeast of Thailand was surrounded by communists. And the local, because I was fluent in Thai, I was living in there at the time, many generals would visit the monastery and talk to my master about their child, I would listen to them. And those generals, they were not really afraid of the communists invading our country, even though they just won 3 big battles against Vietnam, Cambodia and Laos. They said they were exhausted, their resources were just too stretched, it would take them a few years if they wanted to invade. But the general said, our biggest problem is not the communists outside our country, it is the communists inside our country. There are many students disaffected who have run off into the jungles and formed a huge insurgent army trying to overthrow the government. I know that because there's many pink areas, they call them pink areas rather than red areas of Thailand. Mostly in the northeast, and that's where I used to wander to meditate. And many times I had to ask the soldiers, where are the communists? Because if they found me, I would have been killed. They all thought I would be CIA, even though I was English, all white people were CIA trying to undermine the insurgency, dressed up as monks. So I had to ask the soldiers, where are the communists? And they would actually tell me, I remember many times, that mountain over there, there's hundreds of them in there, go to this mountain, that's free. So I could go there to meditate in the jungles. But I was surprised, but if you know where they are, why didn't you go and fight them? He said, no, that's not our policy. We're Buddhists. He said, our policy is non-violence at that particular time. We know where they are, but we're not going to go in there to fight them. Because if we fight them, for every one of those communist insurgents killed, they have brothers, they have friends, they will take their place. A sense of revenge. Okay, what else do you do then? He said, well, why are they fighting us? Why are they fighting the government? Because the government is not doing enough, especially the poor people. So that time the government put lots of roads, electricity, and medical centres in the poor parts of the area of Thailand. And the King of Thailand was really responsible for much of that. That's why the King of Thailand was so well loved when he died recently. People in Thailand are still mourning. It's genuine grief. If you want to know what they feel like, remember Princess Diana, multiply that by about 100. And that's actually how the Thai people are feeling right now. They weep. And anyway, they did the right thing by developing that part of Thailand. And I know many soldiers at the time. And I said, they were sort of guarding the mountains where the insurgents were, but they say, we won't shoot them. We know who they are. They come down to the villages to get supplies. And they go back, we let them come, we let them go. And one of the soldiers told me, he said, what I do, I show them my new wristwatch. Hey, I've just managed to buy this new wristwatch. I show them my new, remember ghetto blasters? The must-have items before iPods. I show them my new ghetto blaster. I show them that the country's getting prosperous. And there's also amnesty, forgiveness. Anytime any one of those communist soldiers wanted to give themselves up, even though many Thai soldiers had died, monks had been tortured and killed in that area. That's why it was very dangerous for me. Because the monks, they were looked as part of the government. You know, communism, religion is the opium of the people, they said. So they didn't like monks at all. And when a couple of monks were tortured and killed, the villagers were so upset, they tried to go up into the mountains to catch those communists and punish them. And the soldiers stopped them. Now you get killed, and this is not what we're trying to do. There was total amnesty. Anytime they wanted to give themselves up, they could. There was a way out. I was there at the time. I saw this happen. After 2 or 3 years, the place was being developed, and so the villagers, but what are you fighting for? We've got a good government. They're doing what a government's supposed to do, looking after the poor, the weak, the sick. So we're not supporting you anymore. So the villagers took away the support from the insurgents. Many of the insurgents had a way out. You know, amnesty, anytime you want, you go back to your university, no questions asked. And they didn't have a reason to get revenge. None of the people had been killed, shot. So it took 2 or 3 years. One by one, the insurgents gave themselves up. I knew this, I saw this. I saw this wonderful article in the Bangkok Post that entrepreneurs were taking tourists to the Great Cave where the communists had their hideout. This is where they lived. And tourists were paying good money for that. But there came the time. This is the beautiful part of the story. There came the time
when the leaders of the communist insurgents gave themselves up. These are the organizers, the ones who planned the massacre of soldiers, who ordered the killing of the monks, the Pol Pots. And when these people gave themselves up, you can't just forgive them like other people. They did terrible stuff. So what the Thai government did, once the government acted really Buddhist, the Thai government doesn't always do this, quite often quite the opposite. But this one time, it was praiseworthy. They not only gave these leaders amnesty, no punishment fellows, they immediately appointed these insurgents to top positions in the civil service, saying, we recognize your skills to organize all these attacks on our soldiers, to motivate so many insurgents to fight against our government. Your endurance living in the jungle, your commitment is something we value. We want to use those skills for the government, for the people, rather than against them. You have good grievances, you have ideas. Come inside and fight with us to make the country a better place. I once gave that story, that talk, in Sydney, in the presence of the Thai consul in Sydney. He stood up to ask a question. He said, there's another question I want to add to your statement. He said, because right now, currently, this was quite a few years ago now, two of those insurgents are now ministers in the Thai government. I thought, wow. Instead of putting them against the wall and shooting them, and wasting, in those days they were just bad people, but they had a beautiful side. They had talents. Why not take those talents and use them for the government? Me, many years ago I said, when Osama bin Laden was not yet killed, I want to find him first. I want to make him treasurer of my Buddhist society. He's got great organizational skills. He has great ways of raising funds. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have him as the treasurer from the 10 Buddhists we have? He could pay off every debt, build huge monasteries. Why not use his skills for a good cause rather than a bad cause? Don't kill him. He's too valuable. Now that is a wonderful Buddhist way of twisting around instead of destroying the person who's bad. Seeing the good in them, encouraging that, and they can be of great service to the world. I don't actually answer your question, but it's a great story. Okay, another question?
I turned around.
Yeah.
How can parents motivate and inspire their children so that they can be the best they can be?
The best. When I was having parents inspire their children to the best. Okay, so you'll be the next at the back of there. I did see you put your hand up. What is the best? When I was young, I was taught that success is a way to be happy. Pass your exams. Go to Cambridge. Get a good degree. Get lots of money and then you'll be happy. But I soon saw through that. I saw many highly educated people becoming depressed. Many great business people becoming depressed. Great successes like Robin Williams, a brilliant comedian, killing himself, suicide. I learned that the person is so successful, not feel happy. And I realized success does not mean happiness. And then I read in some psychology, especially from Davidson's Emotional Intelligence. He actually turned around, I don't agree with him, but this was much better. He said, when you're happy, then you become successful. If you enjoy what you're doing in your career, you're going to be successful. I thought, actually, close, but not accurate. And then I realized, it's not that success leads to happiness, or happiness leads to success. Happiness is success. If you are happy, congratulations, you've made it, you are successful. Not that happiness leads to success. Happiness is success. So, how can you get your kid to be successful? Now you have the answer. Make sure they're happy. Are they happy? Or are they working so hard at their homework? They're stressed out. Are you pushing them so hard? They're so angry at their father. You miss it. A happy kid is successful. Don't worry, I'll say this as a school teacher before, don't worry about their grades at school. That was a great thing with Davidson. This emotional intelligence showed clearly that people who got the highest grades, who went to the best universities, didn't always turn out to be happy and successful in their life. Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Michael Dell, they all dropped out of university. Albert Einstein also dropped out of university. The greatest successes were not the most highly educated. School is good. Let your kids enjoy school to reach whatever potential they have, but not every kid can be in the top 50% of school. In fact, we've got a pretty good distribution of people here. 50% of the children of members of the 10th Buddhist Vihara, 50% of your kids will be below average intelligence. That's obvious, isn't it? What does average mean? It means 50%. I'm only saying the obvious. And you may think, oh yeah, that's true. 50% of kids have to be below average intelligence, but not mine. Somebody else's, but not mine. That is your solution. If 50% have to be below average intelligence, that has to be some of your kids. And it does not matter. Don't think that below average intelligence is a failure. Time for a little funny story. Self-deprecating. This amazing Vietnamese comedian over in Australia. And he tells some amazing jokes. And one of the jokes, I'm half Australian, so this is criticizing me. And he says, he came home from school one day, and the teachers were talking about IQ. IQ. What's IQ? And his father said, IQ means like intelligence level. Look, it works like this. If you get an IQ of 100, you're actually perfectly average. IQ of 120 means you're quite smart. You know, you probably maybe go to a university. IQ of 150, you probably go to Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard or something. You're really smart. If you've got an IQ of 80, maybe, you know, you're not that smart, but you know, you still go well in life. If you've only got an IQ of about 50, you're so stupid, you probably won't even be able to tie up your own shoelaces. And at that, the kid said, oh, is that why most Australians wear thongs? So did you without shoelaces. Or even better, just really deprecating Australians. No, like, you have like the English and the Scots, you know, they always sort of, they're seen as the best. There was that competition. You've got like Oxford and Cambridge always in competition. Where I live, New Zealand and Australia, they're always competing against each other. So some years ago, they had this very smart Prime Minister, Edward Lange. And he was brilliant. You know, even I really admire him because at that time, many New Zealanders were leaving New Zealand to go to Australia. It was like a brain drain. All their highly educated people leaving New Zealand to go to Australia. And so they asked him, what do you think about the brain drain? Australia getting all your best graduates. And he said, all the brain drain only results in increasing the average IQ of both our nations. Now when you think about that, you realise what he's saying. If people going from New Zealand to Australia increases the average IQ of both our nations, it means only the dumb people leave New Zealand, but still they're more intelligent than the average people in Australia. It was such a beautiful put down. It's highly intelligent. So I love people like that. They see something. What was that other great quote that I know we've got? It was Oscar Wilde. Sometimes people with a great mastery of language, you know, he came out of a club. Oscar Wilde was a bit of a debauched person, but so clever. And he came out of a club early one morning, drunk. And this was like 1910, 1920 in London. And there was a very smart old woman, you know, like smartly dressed, one of the high class women, who looked at him and said, "Sir, that is disgusting that you're drunk so early in the morning." And he said, "Yes, madam, I may be drunk, but you're ugly." And he added, "The difference between us is that I'll be sober tomorrow."
Oh, you can't find something like that.
So the command of language can be really tough. I shouldn't say things like that anyway. Anyway, one last question before we can jump here. Oh yeah, no, the gentleman over. Oh, is it? Oh, sorry, yes, okay, yes. How do you make a warm heart? Is actually always allow things to be with kindness. Would you like people to be kind to you, care for you, love you? How does it feel when people like look at you and say, "Thank you so much for that question. They want you to come up. Your mother just wants to make sure you've got the food you like, you're well looked after." That's kindness. And kindness creates this beautiful warmth. So kindness, compassion. If you don't know what kindness and compassion is, have you got a dog or a cat? Have you got a teddy bear? Okay. Tonight, cover the teddy bear with as much kindness. And even though the teddy bear is not really got consciousness, or has it? You sure? Your teddy bear never complains. But anyway, you cuddle it and you get all the feeling of kindness. So you know what kindness is. And you treat your teddy bear like you would like to be treated. You don't throw the teddy bear against the wall. You don't put its head in the toilet and flush it. You're kind. When you're kind like that, it creates a very warm world where everybody feels they're respected and loved. That's how we create kindness. It takes practice like everything else. Because sometimes the people assume that kindness is natural, comes automatically. No, you have to go out of your way to develop practice. Okay. That's 9:30, so it is time for all of you to go home, get something to eat, and go to bed. And it's way past Mum's bedtime too. There's quite a few young people here. I'm sure it's way past your bedtime too. But never mind, it's a special night.
I'm Ross. Yeah. Can I ask my last question, please?
Yeah. If you
can quickly explain what Nirvana is to my children, because they
asked me. What Nirvana is? Okay, it will take 5 minutes.
Okay.
Best explanation of Nirvana I ever got. Five children playing wishing games. The game, the rules of the game go like this. The five children had one wish, and the child who came up with the best wish would win the wishing game. So the first kid said, "If I had a wish, I'd wish for a new computer game." He loved playing on the computers, like many kids do. Very good. Second kid, "What's your wish?" And because he'd heard the first wish, had a bit more time, the second kid said, "If I had a wish, I'd wish for a computer game shop. Because then I can get many computer games, have the shop, so when the next computer game comes out, I can get that too. That's much better." The third kid, more time to think, he said, "If I had a wish, I'd wish for $100 billion US. Because with $100 billion US, first of all, I will buy my own computer shop. But my problem is, even if I own a computer shop, my mother will never allow me to spend my time playing computer games. She says I must do my homework. So the next thing, after my computer shop, I will buy my own school. If I owned a school and pay all the teachers, I would sack them if they tell my mother I'm not doing my homework. So I'll give myself top grades because I own a school. And when I graduate from my own school, I'll buy my own university and give myself an honorary degree in every subject there is. Because I own the university, I can do that. And then that way I can play computer games all night. My mother can't do anything about it. And with $100 billion US, later on in life, when I want something else, with $100 billion US, you cannot spend that in one lifetime unless you're the British government. But human being cannot, an individual can't spend that much. So you'll have enough money to get whatever you want, whenever you want it, whenever you think about it for the rest of your life. Beat that. There's two kids left yet. So the fourth kid, I can beat that. So the fourth kid said, if I had a wish, I would wish for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'll have the computer game shop. For the second wish, I'll have the $100 billion US. And for the third wish, I'll have three more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. There's one child left in the wishing game. And this fifth child managed to get a wish which was clearly superior to the infinity of wishes. The last child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content and happy I never needed any more wishes. That is Nirvana. The last wish, the fourth kid, I wish I had an infinity of wishes granted. That's Mr. Trump. Trump becomes president, so he has power. The third from $100 billion US, that's Bill Gates. Really rich. But beating all of that is so content and happy, I never needed any more wishes ever again. That is Nirvana. That's brilliant. Everyone can understand that. Okay, thank you all for listening. Any announcements before we go?
Yes.
Okay, a few announcements. Please don't go yet.
On behalf of the whole community, sir, thank you very much for the inspiring speech and the discussion, and also the sense of humor. We really appreciate that. And also, the other thing I want to tell everybody that, Ajahn Brahm mentioned about the Anukampa project. I think we would support that. And I repeat again that if any donations, please do give the donations in support of this beautiful project. Thank you very much for attending.
Thank you.
See you again next year.
Okay, so those of you who remember last year that we don't actually count, we say sadhu three times, and we say it not to depress me, with some energy. The three big sadhus. So, did you remember this from last year?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Sadhu. 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 Because you know, being a speaker, sometimes people say, sorry, sorry, sorry. That makes me feel so depressed. Thank you for 3 weeks on this. Okay, good night, everybody. Have a nice evening. A donation box is somewhere outside. Yeah.